Welcome to the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, the nation's key nonpartisan policy forum for tackling global issues through independent research, open dialogue, and informing actionable ideas for the policy community. This is a Wilson Center special event hosted by our experts and scholars. Be sure to check out our other media, videos, audio, and podcasts at wilsoncenter.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Wilson Center, and welcome in particular to our series, Hindsight Up Front. This program is on Ukraine. Our guest today is Bob Zoellick, one of the most recognizable and impactful foreign policy leaders of our time. He has served as president of the World Bank, deputy secretary of state, U.S. trade representative, deputy White House chief of staff, undersecretary of state, Sherpa for G7 summits in 1991 and 1992, and the list goes on. But given all that we see these days, particularly Russia's aggressive posture against Ukraine, there's one particular role that Bob has played that we hope to explore a little further. In 1990, he led the U.S. delegation to the 2+4 talks on German reunification. Bob, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you.
Glad to be with you.
You know, you and I have talked about it before, but several years ago, I had the chance to meet privately with General Scowcroft, Ben Scowcroft. And we were talking a bit about those days and German reunification. And I asked him if there was any lesson that he would share with today's young people. And he said, he looked at me and he said, tell them it wasn't easy. He said, you know, we tend to look back on history and think everything was smooth and easy. He said it was really hard and it was in doubt and it wasn't always easy. Well, you were right there. Do you agree? It wasn't easy.
It was amazing because if you think about it, the wall opens up in November of 89, and the treaty completing the external aspects of unification is done by the following September. So as you know, what happens in Washington or international politics within a year? But that momentum on the ground was part of the story. So I was privileged to have a chance to work with Secretary Baker and President Bush on it.
Did you know at the time, did you have a sense of history and that you would have this role in helping to shape the future, what the world looks like these days?
Well, it's interesting. We saw during the transition, you know, I worked on President Bush 41's election. I'd worked with Secretary Baker at the Treasury Department. So, you know, I was a close in sort of aide and colleague with Baker. As you mentioned, I would became an undersecretary of state with the title of counselor. And you could see that the ice of the Cold War was breaking. But this actually reflected a slightly different sort of strategic view. If you go back and look at the work of, say, George Shultz, he would argue that the Cold War ended in 1988 because of the improved relations with the Soviet Union. The Bush-Baker view was different. The Bush-Baker view was the Cold War began in the heart of Europe. It began in Berlin and in Germany. And until you had a Europe whole and free, the Cold War was not over. Now, the tricky part, of course, was that the Reagan administration had the INF Treaty. That's the Intermediate Range Missiles Treaty to eliminate all those missiles. That left, however, the short-range missiles, the SNF missiles, and NATO was committed to modernize that. And as one of the Germans said at the time, the shorter the missiles, the deader the Germans. It wasn't too popular to do that. And so it's pretty much forgotten now. But as early as May of 89, Bush comes up with this very bold conventional forces proposal to reduce and equalize the armies, the airplanes, the helicopters in Central Europe. And that pushes the nuclear issue aside. It links the United States with Germany, and it shows that Bush is the alliance leader. So you could feel, the reason I mention this is that I, as early as May, I wrote a note to Baker saying, you know, you have to prepare for the prospect of unification. President Bush, in a press conference or in an interview in May, is the first leader that suggests that, you know, we ought to be open to the idea of reunification, which, you know, as you know, at the time was seen as a taboo across Europe.
And of course, it all takes on new relevance today because Vladimir Putin is trying to recast what's happening on the border with Ukraine, hearkening back to these days. In particular, he's claiming, and his message bearers are claiming, that Bush 41, Baker, and therefore you had represented that NATO wouldn't expand. So he looked back at 1990 and said, look, they lied to us. They broke promises. They told us NATO wouldn't expand eastward. And look, they're breaking their promises. We don't have a choice. This is a Russian, almost defensive measure.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, he is a former KGB agent, so disinformation is not a new tactic. But so let's kind of review the context. I mentioned the wall opened in November of 89. As you may recall, events were moving very quickly on the ground. And this created a momentum that the diplomats and the heads of government sort of had to address. In February of 90, Baker goes to Moscow. And his prime purpose was to try to convince Gorbachev and the Soviets that we needed an external process to match what looked like was happening on the ground, the internal unification. And that's what led to the so-called 2+4. And the logic there was you had the two Germanys in the front, and we wanted to emphasize that because we didn't want to block unification. But the four were the four powers coming out of World War II and the Potsdam Accords. So the United States, Soviet Union, Great Britain, and France. And the reason you needed some group like that was you still had the four power rights from World War II, including over Berlin. You had 380,000 troops in the East. And so we needed an external mechanism that sort of matched what we hope would be the internal mechanism. While there, Baker was also making the argument that the Soviets should agree to a united Germany in NATO. Now, again, we've sort of assumed over 30 years this is an acceptable idea. At the time, this was seen as very controversial, if you look at the editorial opinion. And Baker posed a hypothetical to Gorbachev. He said, you know, would you prefer to have a united Germany, sort of independent, neutral, not linked to the West, in the heart of Europe, or would you prefer to have a united Germany in NATO with the jurisdiction not one inch further? Now, what he was trying to do was he was trying to force Gorbachev to face a difficult choice. Of course, Gorbachev didn't want a united Germany in NATO given the Cold War history. But how did he like the idea of sort of recreating a powerful Germany in the center of Europe that might have to worry about its security and its borders and others? So in a sense, Baker was hearkening back to the experience of the 20th century. Now, it's that hypothetical that Putin goes back on. But then one has to look at what happens during the rest of 1990. So that's February. In March, you have the elections in East Germany. It's overwhelmingly support for Kohl and the idea of unification. In June, Gorbachev comes to Washington. And this is really the key moment where he accepts the idea of a united Germany in NATO. And the logic there really undermines Putin's argument, because I had discovered that in the CSCE principles, that's the Helsinki Final Act, there is language that all the parties had agreed to, and Gorbachev actually was a big supporter of the CSCE principles, that countries should be free to join their own alliance. So President Bush says to President Gorbachev, Mr. President, we believe Germany should be in NATO, but can we both agree that under CSCE principles, Germany should be free to decide? And Gorbachev says yes, to the surprise of everybody. And I remember on the other side of the table, you can almost feel the Soviets starting to physically distance themselves away from Gorbachev. Bob Blackwell, who's on NSC staff, sends me a note saying, did you hear this? You know, and should we ask the president to repeat it? And yes. So we give a note to President Bush, and Bush repeats it, and Gorbachev sort of agrees again. Now, you know, nothing's ever final until you've sort of put the words on paper. One further step we took was that a couple of days later, they had a joint press conference, Bush and Gorbachev. And we had the Bush opening statement, which we repeated the same idea about having Germany under CSCE principles decide its alliance. And we showed that to the Soviets, and there was no objection. So, you know, that's a big hole for Putin, because if the basis was Helsinki principles, well, then what happens to other countries that may want to join NATO? But the critical part, of course, as you know from your international experience, is this all had to be worked out in that 2+4 agreement. And that's what gets done during the course of 1990. And there is language in the agreement that limits the notion of NATO in the former East Germany. It's quite specific. Until the Soviets leave, there's no foreign forces. After 1994, when they leave, Germany could have its NATO forces, but there would be no non-German NATO forces in the eastern states, except they wouldn't be able to be stationed or deployed there. So there's nothing in the treaty that precludes Poland or others joining NATO. And indeed, you know, I have to smile if anybody's watched Soviet or Russian diplomacy. The idea that the Russians would say, oh, yeah, you posed a hypothetical to us and that's good enough, we don't have to get it in writing, is a little crazy given you, if you watch how the Russians act. It's interesting to note that Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, Kozarev, the Russian foreign minister, both say there was no promise. But I have one other interesting little anecdote, which is on the last night before the treaty was signed in Moscow in September, we were quarreling over the definition of deployed. You know, what does deployed mean, that you couldn't have non-German NATO forces deployed in the East? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, someday Poland may want to come into NATO and the U.S. may need the ability to move forces across the former East Germany, and I don't want that blocked. Now, I didn't put the hypothetical out on the table, but I wanted to make sure that the language permitted it. And there was a big kerfluffle overnight that the historians have written about, which we finally agreed the next morning to say, well, the definition of deployed will be up to United Germany and taking into account these issues, which I thought was safe enough since Germany would be a NATO member. So those are all factors that, you know, at the end of the day, you have to look at the treaty language. You have to look at the basis of how Gorbachev came to the decision. But as we both said, you know, Putin will use any leverage he can.
Well, what's fascinating, and you laid it out so beautifully, it's not really recollections and differing recollections, but instead it's objective, because it's right in there. The topic of NATO is covered, and what's excluded from it or not included in it, it shows, in fact, that there was no effort to limit NATO expansion. But, you know, on top of that, and you point this out in something that you recently wrote, when NATO began to add members in the 1990s, and there was a NATO-Russia founding act, there were no restrictions made at that time. It wasn't raised. So if in fact it had been a promise or a guarantee of any kind back during the 2+4, one would assume that Russia would complain if in fact other countries were being brought in.
You're exactly right. So I was no longer in government in the 90s. It was the Clinton administration. But Wolfgang Ischinger, who is a senior German diplomat, head of the Munich Security Conference, you know, told me that when he was representing Germany, and NATO had a delegation go to speak to the Russians about this founding act, he said the Russians never mentioned at that time that there was a precluding of enlarging NATO, which of course they certainly would have if they believed that promise had been created. But the other point in this, you know, given the what you're trying to draw out for the Wilson Center, that I think is important for people to realize, is that, you know, effective diplomacy often will require testing ideas. You know, if it's so often the way it's covered in the press, it's, you know, officials state their position, and if the other side doesn't agree, well, they'll state it even more loudly, but more slowly or something. And what you saw in the 89-90 period, and where Baker was obviously an extraordinary, you know, skillful advocate and negotiator, was that, as you said, this is very difficult to foresee. You had these extraordinary events after 40 years of the Cold War. And Baker was trying to find some way to accomplish the objectives the United States wanted, the United Germany and NATO, but also try to recognize Soviet interests and concerns. And frankly, trying out ideas, and I know from my own experience, and you certainly sort of know that, is what you do if you're really trying to find solutions. So that's what happened in the process. The reason I reference that is, you know, we're in a phase now with Ukraine where, you know, there are ideas out there that the United States and NATO have put forward to the Russians to say, look, if you're concerned about security, we can do things with missiles. Actually, this CFE treaty that I mentioned, the conventional forces, that's another vehicle that one could sort of recall and try to figure out for troop movements and other issues. You have to try out these ideas. The part today that I think, Mark, we may be missing a bit is if our real objective is to try to make sure that Ukraine preserves its independence as a democracy, you can see that a lot of the Russian efforts really seem designed to subvert the political and economic system. You know, they're trying to put pressure on it, even short of an invasion. You see the cyber attacks, the intelligence reports about trying to find somebody pro-Russian and depose the president. I think one of the missing parts of the U.S. strategy should be ways that we gain some leverage by focusing on the economic and political strength of Ukraine. So if you look at it, our diplomacy tends to be now more reactive. The Soviets basically, you know, have the initiative. In addition to sending the military arms, which I think one needs to do so Ukraine can defend itself, I've noticed the Europeans are starting to put some economic support in. And this would be the moment that the United States should go to the Congress, those senators that visited Kiev, and say, look, you know, let's put a broad economic support package conditioned on Ukrainians working together as opposed to splitting up politically, and some of the reforms and anti-corruption measures that have been needed. And so it's in some ways that almost harkens back to the Marshall Plan. You know, the Marshall Plan was designed to bring Europe together economically, politically, to withstand the then Soviet threat. And so this is, I think, an area where the United States could take an initiative and regain some leverage. And it focuses on the heart of the issue. How do we make sure that an independent, democratic Ukraine survives?
You know, it's interesting. I think you're also pointing to something, a concern that many of us have, is there's a lot of U.S.-Russia negotiations. Sometimes you feel a little bit as though Ukraine is being left out of the conversation. Good news is we hear from Ukraine that they're being consulted all the time, but really this is about Ukraine. And so Ukraine should be front and center, strengthening Ukraine. And you're right. We certainly have to do what we're doing in the hard power sense. But what Ukrainians are really looking for is self-determination, private enterprise, the ability to join the system, the rules-based system in the West. Isn't that what we should do? That's the way that we can bring together the right result.
Yeah, and look, this just my own view is that, you know, I think the prospect of Ukraine coming into NATO is very, very low, in part because I don't think we should bring countries in unless we're willing to fight and defend them. And I'm not sure that's where the American public is today. But that's not the same as saying that Ukraine should be controlled by Russia. And to me, the heart of the matter would be if Ukraine can succeed as an economy and democracy, I'm comfortable with it having constructive relations with Russia as well as the West. That's not trying to create a new Berlin Wall here. But the starting point is not to let Russia intimidate or undermine Ukraine. And of course, ultimately, as you know from your experience globally, you know, it depends on the Ukrainians. They've got to clean up some of the economic and corruption problems that they've had. You got to make sure the democracy works. But the best way to do that is to show the type of support, not just militarily, but in terms of some of the economic.
So crystal ball time. What do you think is going to happen in coming weeks?
Well, I have a slightly contrarian view, which is that, you know, Putin wants to be very careful about his Chinese wingman. And we're just beginning the Winter Olympics. So most Americans haven't noticed this. But I think Putin would be cautious about starting a conflict while the Winter Olympics is going on. After the Winter Olympics goes on, I think it depends on kind of the state of negotiations. My own guess was that the Russian effort would be more to undermine the political system, as you've seen with some of the espionage reports. And I think you have to expect this in the cyber area. So much will depend on whether Ukraine sort of keeps its cohesion. I think it's possible that as time goes on, that Russia might take some military action, not to try to take over the whole country, but either in the south of Mariupol to try to connect with Crimea or some of the other areas. But again, the strategy is to try to destabilize the government in Kiev, to sort of break the will of people, which again comes back to why, if you know, we're not going to put American forces on the ground, I don't think we should, but there are ways in which we can help strengthen the will of the Ukrainian people and the economic sustenance. But at the same time, you know, I think a willingness to listen to Russian concerns about whether you can deal with maneuvers or conventional forces or missiles, that's a responsible action. I just, as a negotiator, Mark, prefer to have a little leverage as I do that.
So, Bob, you've been very generous with your time. James Baker's book, The Politics of Diplomacy, refers to you as one of Secretary Baker's inner circle, combining Midwest common sense with policy sophistication, superb manager, policy analyst, and writer, and Baker's second brain. Bob, thank you for being Baker's second brain then and our brain today. I really appreciate your insights. Thanks for all that you've done. And thanks for all you continue to do. Thanks very much.
I'm pleased that someone from Wisconsin can recognize somebody as Illinois as a Midwestern.
You know, I think that that's a tall order. You're right. Bob, it's great to be with you again. Thanks.
Thanks for having me. Bye, Mark.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this Wilson Center special event. This has been a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Be sure to check out more of the Wilson Center's activities, media, and events at wilsoncenter.org.